Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Confirm Unit seminar. Today, we're happy to have Ilya Portnoy from MIT. He's a mathematician, but he recently did very interesting work in error coding code. And today, he's going to talk about local common code from subdivided manifolds. Okay, Ilya, it's all yours.
Okay. Thanks for having me. This is my first talk to an audience that it's not just a lot of mathematicians, so I'll do my best to, I don't know, make things understandable from both sides. And please stop me if you have any questions regarding anything. Today I'll talk about a problem in quantum computing, and it's about making quantum codes that can be sort of put into a physical architecture in an efficient way. And I'll call these codes local, and I'll define them later on. And the main thing that I think people are interested in is to make quantum codes with large distances so that they're kind of, they don't get affected by noise as much. They're robust with respect to error correction. And so I'm gonna try to give a construction of a local code with a large distance. That's going to be the goal of the talk. it's mostly putting together things other people did. So I just wanted to make that clear. So mostly Larry Guth, Matt Hastings, Mike Friedman, Misha Gromov, Leverrier, Zimor, and all the people who did the asymptotically good codes before. So I'll just start with the definition of the quantum codes, which I'm going to be working with. So they're called CSS codes, Calderbank-Shor-Stein codes. And they're basically, they're a three-term chain complex of F2 vector spaces, and you choose a basis in each of these vector spaces. And the picture is you have a map from C2 to C1 to C0, and then there's boundary maps, the transpose of H2 and H1, and they satisfy that condition. And then the dimension of the code is going to be the dimension of the kernel of H1 mod the image of the transpose of H2. And the distance of the code is it's the smallest Hamming weight of a vector, which is in the kernel of H1, but not in the transpose of H2, or in the kernel of H2, but not in the image of H1 transpose. So roughly what this means is that you have the qubits are the basis for C1, and the number of logical qubits is the dimension of the code, and like how robust it is to error correction is the distance. So if you have some error that's smaller than the distance, you should be able to find the logical qubit which the error acted on. And then the code is LDPC, low density parity check, if H1 and H2 are very sparse matrices. So H1 and H2 are just matrices with entries in 0, 1. And you want most, for each row and column, at most a constant number of ones. So somehow they're not complicated to implement. And then I'll just denote the size of the code as the dimension of C1, so which is the number of qubits, just for the sake of making notation here. Any questions so far in this step? Okay, I'll assume that it's maybe with you then. So we're interested in, as I said, codes that are kind of easily to implement in a physical architecture, and here's what it means like mathematically. So we'll say a code is local if we can place its qubits, i.e. each basis vector in C1, into a cube in a three-dimensional lattice. So that's what I'm calling QV. And the size of the volume of that cube is V, which is the number of qubits. And we want to place the qubits inside this lattice so that each check of the code is around some small ball of a point in the lattice, constant radius from some point. And the check is basically all the qubits involved in some row of H1 or H2. Yeah, so somehow you don't want, like, it's hard to build a, supposedly it's hard to build a quantum computer if the checks are acting on qubits very far apart of the cube. So the idea is you want checks to act only on qubits that are close together. And the cube itself is like the physical space you put the qubits in. That's the idea. Okay. And I wanted to save this result for reference, and it's going to, I think it's kind of the most important tool in all of this probably. It's a result of, I think, Pantaleev Kalachev, Leverrier Zimor, maybe some other people too, that there is very, very good quantum correcting codes. So what that means is that for any V, there's a quantum code C prime with whose number of qubits is bigger than V and whose distance is roughly as big as the number of qubits. So up to some constant. So this is as good as you can hope for theoretically for quantum correcting codes. And I'm just going to call these codes asymptotically good. I'm not sure what the actual name is. Okay. And the result that I was working on recently is that there is a local code whose size is V up to some polylog factor and whose distance is V to the 2/3 and whose dimension is V to the 1/3. And so these 2/3 and 1/3, they turn out to be basically optimal, except for the polylog factor that was known before. And what's new is the construction for these codes. And so I'm going to try to explain a little bit of where they come from. And I just wanted to also briefly mention this conjecture, which I think is, it's not too hard for proof given the tools, for theorem one, is that, there is another code so that for any constant D, and the code is local, it has roughly the parameters of a toric code. So its distance is like square root of its size, and it has an Erentge barrier of also roughly square root, minus some small factor in the exponent. So I won't go into the energy barrier, but if anybody has thought about this, I wanted to put a little more motivation for this method. So I think this is an approachable conjecture. Any questions so far about the statements of theorem one? Okay. So, so I thought a little bit about how to organize this. I think I'm going to jump straight into the geometry, and along the way, I'll try to motivate why it's relevant. But for the sake of time, I want to start talking about what is the geometrical object that we need to understand. So these are triangulated manifolds. So we'll let M denote a triangulated D-dimensional manifold. So what that roughly means is that you have something that's a generalization of like a torus. I don't know if people know what a manifold is. Maybe tell me if that's kind of common knowledge. It's common knowledge. Okay, great. And so you triangulate them with roughly unit simplices. And the volume, I'll just denote, it's the number of D-dimensional simplices. And these things carry smaller dimensional geometrical objects that somehow capture their topology. And so here's how we'll define them. A K-cycle is a set of K-simplices with no boundary. And the K-boundary is a set of K-simplices, which is a boundary of a set of K plus one simplices. And the SISTO is the minimum number of K simplices needed to represent a K cycle that is not a K boundary. So maybe that's knowledge, maybe that's a mouthful, but I have a few examples to make that maybe more palatable. So if you have a torus that looks like this, so it starts very thickly and then it gets very small. The one systole, it's going to be the smallest number of edges you need to represent a non-contractible loop, roughly. And so it's that red, in this picture, would be the red loop I drew and not the black loop. So the size of that red loop is the one systole of this torus. The torus is supposed to be triangulated. And we're going to be mostly working with higher dimensional manifolds. So maybe another picture to have in mind is a higher dimensional thing is if you let Si of R be a dimensional I sphere with radius R, which is triangulated by unit simplices, you can define a manifold as a product of a K sphere and a D minus K sphere. And I put in the radius so that both spheres have volume square root of V. Then the volume would be V because it's just a product of the volumes of the spheres. The K systole is the volume of the K sphere and the D minus K systole is the product of the D minus K sphere. So in this case, both of them are square root of V, but if you change the radius of these spheres, the K systole and the D minus K systole will change. So it's the K systole is like the size of the smallest K dimensional hole. That's roughly what it means. So another property that will be important for us is that we'll say a map is coarse, a map from a manifold to R3 is coarse. If the image of each simplex in M has diameter O of one, so it doesn't stretch simplices in the image. And the pre-image of unit balls of each unit ball intersects O of one simplices. So not too many simplices get squished together at a point. So it somehow doesn't, it doesn't change the geometry too much at a local scale. That's roughly what coarse means. And an example is if you take a two torus in R3, just like imagine a normal, nothing weird about the geometry, just a normal two torus, you can squash it down to a two-dimensional plane. This would be a coarse map because the pre-image of each unit ball, the pre-image actually of a point has intersects two simplices. I drew it in red. And each simplex doesn't get stretched because the map actually doesn't increase distances. And this is actually a picture also for a toric code being local, because a toric code is it's like putting a qubit on each edge of this triangulation of this torus and putting a check at each vertex and each triangle. I don't know if that's familiar as well, or if that's worth discussing. It's good, okay, yeah. So in order to show that a toric code is local, we have to put it into a three-dimensional space, but we might as well put it into a two-dimensional space that's even better. And so this is a picture of how to put the qubits of the toric code into a two-dimensional space. And not too many checks get mapped into a unit ball because the checks are like, they're near the simplices. They're like the vertices and the simplices themselves. Okay. So this is starting to motivate why I'm using manifolds, hopefully. And here's the dictionary that is kind of, I think, the reason there is like geometers care about quantum codes and the other way around. So this is basically a one-to-one correspondence between codes and manifolds and their properties. Maybe not one-to-one, but very.
Can I ask a question about your previous slide? So what's going on about the pre-image of the boundary, like somewhere near the boundary?
So the boundary gets mapped to like a loop like this. But I'm not sure there's anything special.
Let's say because you are going to project a 2D torus to a 2D plane, then right. if I take a pre-image of the of somewhere near the boundary of the 2D disk,
right?
Then I would imagine that the its pre-image is pretty large. It could be pretty large, even if your image is small. It's like you have a circle, but prepared to a 1D line. Now you take the pre-image of this small interval, map to somewhere here. It is still large.
I'm not sure I understand. So you're taking the pre-image of this piece here that I drew in blue?
Right.
And then it would map to roughly this like cap of the torus.
Yes, then but you said that the pre-image of each unit ball should intersect only O1 number of simplices.
Oh yeah, but I think it still does. I mean the torus kind of looks like this cap is still looks like a unit disk roughly.
So even if your qubits are pretty dense, it's still allowed? Even if your triangulation is pretty dense?
Oh, I see. Yeah, so the triangulation shouldn't be dense. It should be...
I see. Thank you. I see.
I didn't say that, but...
I see.
Yes, I should have said that. Like, it's a torus with a standard triangulation. So mm-hmm. maybe it's at most... five triangles touch each vertex, and each edge of the triangle has length 1/10 or something.
I see. Thanks so much. So,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, so this is the dictionary. If you have a code, I'll start calling it C prime. It corresponds to some triangulated D manifold M. D will be bigger than 11 or bigger than 10 for some technical reasons. The size, the number of qubits is like the volume of M roughly. Well, sorry, the size is like the volume and the number of qubits is like the number of K simplices for some K that we choose. The distance of the code is like the minimum of the K systole and the D minus K systole. So what's important is that it's two systoles in dimensions that add up to D, the dimension of the manifold. And for technical reasons, also there's some restrictions on K, but they're not that big. So in the toric code, we saw that in the sphere example, the K systole and the D minus K systole were both like square root of V. So that manifold would correspond to a quantum code whose distance was square root the number of qubits. The dimension of the code is like the dimension of the k-dimensional homology. I just put that in there if you know what homology is, but otherwise I decided not to focus on that. The code is LDPC if each vertex in M is adjacent to O of one simplices. So maybe that's getting at G's question. All the manifolds we consider will have this property. They're gonna have at most like 100 simplices adjacent to a vertex or something like that. Otherwise, we'll have to change the constants everywhere. and a code is local if the map from the manifold, if there's a map from the corresponding manifold to a ball of volume M in R3. So that's what happened in this toric code example. So if we start with C prime with some properties, we get an M with the corresponding properties and vice versa. And going from the left side of the table to the right side of the table, this is a result of Friedman-Hastings pretty recently. And it's some interesting work in topology of manifolds, and going the other way is actually much easier. It's basically how homological codes are made. So I'm mostly relying on Friedman-Hastings construction for this paper. Okay. Yes, you should please just ask a question.
Hi, sorry, quick question about this local thing just to make sure I understand. So the 2D toric code, like if you're kind of being strict about, so it's not like planar, right? Because I need these like long range connections if I was actually to make it in 2D, but this is kind of allowed by your definition. Does that make sense?
What are the long range connections?
Like, let's say I wanted to build it on like a superconducting processor, then, you know, I have on the boundary when it kind of wraps around, then I would need like a long range connection between qubits. I was just asking if you're kind of considering these kind of constraints at all, or if it's.
Are you saying that I'm not super familiar with these long range connections. Are you saying that like when you build a torus, you have to connect from here to here or
exactly.
Something else?
Yeah.
I'm just imagining it as like a torus like this. Mm-hmm. And in this case, there is no long range connections because it's just connected. These endpoint, sides that you connect are just a loop in the torus.
Yeah, I think I was only just a bit confused because of your, so it's like if you're putting the torus, it kind of can live in R3, fine. But then if you wanted to put it in like R2, then you need these long range things, but you're considering things that just live in R3.
So you're not embedding the torus in R2, you're squashing it into R2. So this picture is actually not, so I can work with this picture, but then the map to R3 would be different. It would be like the first coordinate. So if we imagine where the first coordinate in R2 gets mapped to, it would be like 0, it goes up to 1, and then, or maybe square root of V, and then it goes back down to 0.
Mm-hmm.
So the two sides actually get wrapped around.
Okay.
So if we, I don't know, I could write it out in more detail. If the coordinates here are X, Y, the map to R2 would be like X minus square root of V over 2, absolute value Y minus square root of V over 2, absolute value. And this is then just a map, a continuous map from the torus to R2.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not like an embedding like I was thinking. Okay, thanks for the clarification.
Yeah, no, that's actually kind of, it's important. You cannot have... you can't really embed high dimensional manifolds in low dimensional spaces. So, thank you.
Can I ask a question? Sorry. I was confused by your restriction on dimension D. You said D has to be bigger than 11 or something.
At least 11. Sorry. Yeah.
But I'm confused. So then you're mapping from this 11 dimensional manifold or higher to R3 eventually by some discourse mapping. And, but it still remains somehow local despite being created. Uh huh. But if I do.
So it's not.
Mm-hmm. But it, suppose I take, for example, five dimensional toric code and try to squish it, that will not remain local.
So these, what's special about these 11 dimensional manifolds is they're very close to two dimensional manifolds in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like imagine your manifold is like, you live inside a 12 dimensional space. You take a two dimensional disk and you take a little neighborhood of it.
Mm-hmm.
That little neighborhood is 11 dimensional. The boundary is 11 dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. This is a two-dimensional disk. This is R12. R12. And then you take a little neighborhood of this disk in R12. That's going to be an 11-dimensional space, but it's going to be very close to a two-dimensional space in some sense. You could just squash it very easily.
I see. So these are so in some sense very special. I see.
Yes. Yes. They don't look like...
Uh-huh, I see. So they don't look like RD.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But if we have that little wiggle room in 11 dimensions, somehow we can put in a lot of homology information. this very large and this very large. That's the surprising thing.
Yeah, that's very surprising. Yeah, thanks.
Cool. Okay. So I'm gonna try to sketch the idea of proof now. I'm worried this part is a little technical, but thought I'd give it a shot. So I'll start with the rough outline. So we'll start with C prime, which is an asymptotically good code. So that, like, the recent breakthrough of codes whose distance is kind of like the number of qubits. And we're gonna turn them into a manifold, 11 dimensional or 12 dimensional, whatever. And V will be like their volume, just gonna be a symbol I'll use for the volume and the number of qubits roughly. And they'll have the K dimensional system, the D minus K dimensional system will be also roughly like V. And this, there's kind of no shortcut to just create this manifold without the code actually. So that's the reason I'm starting with the code, because these manifolds themselves, we only know how to create using code. And then step two is to do this squashing, which I described. So it's, this manifold is somehow close to a two-dimensional complex, and we're gonna need to use a map to this two-dimensional complex. So I'll call that map rho. And so we'll find a coarse map rho from M to this two-dimensional complex X. And then step three is to map to find a map I from X to a ball in R3 with small pre-images, but so that it's this stretches the stretches each simplex quite a bit. So in step three, the map is not coarse, but it has some feature of a coarse map. And the reason we do this is because there was results previously known about how to do this. And it's sort of believable because you're mapping a two-dimensional thing into R3. It's also not an embedding, but not too many of the simplices in X intersect in R3. That's the key feature. Okay. And then step four is we subdivide M to get M tilde, and we subdivide X to get X tilde until we have this two coarse maps, like rho and I become coarse maps. And so we have a map from M tilde to X tilde and from X tilde to R3. And both of these maps are coarse. And it's not hard to see that the composition of two coarse maps is coarse. And so now you've started with a very interesting manifold and you've manipulated it to get a coarse map into a ball with subdivision. And then step five is to go back to codes, turn this M tilde into a code. And that's it for the sketch. Another point here is I thought a while about how to just do step four for quantum codes. Like that's, step four is where we actually need the structure of the manifold, because it's not clear what subdivision means for a quantum code. So somehow when you subdivide on a manifold, like you preserve the property of a chain complex. Like H2 transpose composed with H1 is zero. And it's not clear what it means to do something to the qubits of the code, somehow subdivide them and to preserve that property. So if someone wants to get rid of manifolds and all this picture, I think they somehow need to figure out how to do this for codes.
So in some sense, the Friedman Hastings procedure is not functorial.
Can you say a bit more?
I mean, you basically start from a code and you do this Friedman-Hastings procedure to get the manifold, and you do subdivision of the manifold, but you don't know how to translate the subdivision back to the code.
Yeah.
So am I correct that in some sense this Fred-Mackey-Jeans procedure is not in something natural or contrarious, so that you don't know how to.
Yeah, so it's there's probably a bunch of ways to make a manifold from a code, and Friedman-Hastings just found one of them. Not factorial in that sense. They also introduce a lot of auxiliary geometry and topology so that to like match the definition of systole to the distance, like, and that's the reason that D is very high, that the dimension is like 11. It's like every time they try to do it with a lower dimension, somehow like different dimensional, the topology of different dimensions kind of interacted to like give you like extra k dimensional things whose size was much smaller than the distance. Mm-hmm. That was the issue. Yeah,
I see.
Yeah. So I'm not sure there is like a functorial procedure, but maybe there is a way to somehow like understand the procedure and manifolds and then turn it back to just doing a procedure in code. I mean, technically there is one, right? There, you can write a computer program that just takes in a code and outputs its subdivision, but it's not clear conceptually what that is without the manifold. Okay. And now I think I'll just give some more details for these steps. That was my plan. So first, what is X? X is related to the combinatorial structure which you use to create the code. So I think X is actually, in a sense, much more related to the code than to the manifold. And this is another reason that there's hope that maybe subdividing, we can just understand what the subdivision does to the code by understanding the subdivision to X. So for instance, if the code is made with something called the two-sided Cayley complex, which is the one I understand best, then X roughly looks like that two-dimensional Cayley complex thing that you use to create the code. And in some more details, here's a very rough sketch of what the Friedman-Hastings procedure is. So for each basis element of C0, they create a manifold, which is a red piece, and the manifold roughly looks like a small k-dimensional sphere inside a little neighborhood of a k-dimensional sphere inside RD, something like that. And each basis element of C1 is a green piece. And a green piece is like it kind of looks like a bunch of tentacles attaching to these spheres. And then a basis element of C2 will be like a blue piece of the manifold. And these are kind of the most complicated to describe, but they kind of attach between green pieces and red pieces. In some way. The important thing is that all of these pieces, they're just made up of like 1,000 simplices. They have some finite topology, and we're gluing them together to create this very this manifold with a very complicated structure. And the way we glue them is dictated by the maps H2 and H1 of the code. So the boundary, like the boundary maps between the pieces, is like the boundary maps in the code. To get this map to X, we use this construction called the nerve. And the way this works is that for each piece of M, it corresponds to a vertex of X. And if two pieces intersect, that corresponds to an edge between those vertices. And if three pieces intersect, that corresponds to a two-dimensional triangle in X. And there's a natural, I guess that it's not too hard to imagine how to do this map then. The important thing is that there is no spot where four different pieces intersect. So that somehow, the feature of this manifold, which makes it look two-dimensional. You can break it up into three different pieces so that only three of them intersect. This is like the feature of R2. Like you can cover R2 by three balls of different colors, like red, blue, green. So that every point in R2 only is inside three balls of three different colors, but you can't do it to R3. It's impossible to cover R3 with balls of three different colors so that each point is in at most three balls. So it also is related to the fact that the code is like a chain complex made out of three pieces. That's roughly the picture. It's not really more complicated than this. Okay. And then the next important ingredient is this map from X to R3, from this two-dimensional complex to R3. And this is actually, I think, a really pretty piece of mathematics. So maybe I'll give it a few more minutes. And so this was actually, it started by mapping graphs into R3 way back in the 80s by this Russian mathematician called Magorov. And it was very big in the computer science community. And then in 2011, Gromov Guth changed it slightly to map higher dimensional things into balls in Euclidean space. And the key thing about this is that it uses randomness. So the way it works is you take each vertex of X and you map it to a random point in the boundary of a ball of volume V cubed. V is like roughly the number of simplices we have in X. And then we extend, so we'll do that to the vertices. We'll be kind of a random map. We still haven't settled on what it is. Which will map the vertices to boundary points in the sphere, and then we'll extend it linearly to the simplices. So each edge will map to a straight line between wherever the vertices get mapped to, and so on. And then we have to do a probability computation to show that this map obeys that property that we want with some non-zero probability, namely that at most like 100 simplices intersect in any point in the ball, in the image. That's what it means to have small pre-images. A map has small pre-images. If the pre-image of every unit ball intersects at most 100 simplices, and that means that like in the image, the picture of the map is like at most 100 simplices intersect that unit ball. So let's begin this computation just to get a sense of it. So the probability that a fixed simplex delta intersects the pre-image of a unit ball is roughly like V inverse. So why is that? This is the same as the probability that a random ball intersects a fixed simplex in the image. So picking vertices randomly is roughly the same as fixing a vertex and then picking a random ball. So the size of delta in the image is like V squared, because it looks like a two-dimensional object with vertices on the boundary. And the radius of this ball is V. And the total size of this ball is V cubed. So the probability that a unit ball intersects the image of delta is like v squared over v cubed. There's any question? Okay, cool. So the expected number of simplices, this is the expected number of simplices that intersect the preimage of a fixed unit ball. It's at most a cond because there's roughly V simplices. Okay, and then you apply a Chernoff bound in probability to get the probability that the number of simplices that intersect the preimage of a fixed unit ball is bigger than C log V, where C is some constant, is at most this exponential thing, which is like very small. It's like V to some epsilon. V to the minus C. And then you just do a union bound over all the unit balls. So you multiply the probability on right by the number of unit balls, which is V cubed. So as long as C is bigger than 3, the probability that the number of simplices that intersect the preimage of any unit ball is bigger than C log V is way less than 1. So now you've chosen with pretty high probability a map so that at most log V simplices intersect at any point in the image. And then you have to kind of keep going more probability arguments and tweak it until you get the map with your desired property. And then the only other detail here I wanted to say is that this polylog in the theorem, the reason it's there is because of this computation, because there is this log V here. So if you can get rid of this log V somehow, then you would get rid of the polylog. Any questions about this? I only have one component. Okay. So what happens to the systole of M after we subdivide? Right. So what's the important point here? The simplices get stretched a lot, right? A simplex in X goes to a simplex with like area V squared. So it's not a coarse map from X to the ball. So we'll have to subdivide it. Like we'll have to subdivide each simplex in X into like V squared simplices. So that now in the image, like each simplex will actually be a unit simplex. So that will be the next step. And this would somehow change the geometry of the manifold. When you subdivide it, the systole goes down. And we want to understand how the systole goes down because that would correspond to how the distance of the code goes down after we turn the manifold into a code.
Sorry, could I ask a question? I think I missed something. So at the stage where you've mapped to something in two dimensions, That's not a local code defined in 2D. Like, what is this object in 2D?
It's a two-dimensional simplicial. So it's like a two-dimensional simplicial complexes. It's a bunch of two-dimensional triangles glued together. It's not a code per se.
But then, how does this additional map to R3 turn it into a code?
It doesn't. It's just we're just trying to show that we're just trying to find a way to subdivide M to make it local. That's the goal for now. So we begin with a map from M to R3.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we do that is we first map it into a two-dimensional thing, which is easier to map into R3. And then we subdivide both M and X so that this map into R3 is now local, meaning each simplex gets mapped into like a ball of radius 1. The reason we're trying to do that is because then the code we get back will be local. Sorry, we're trying to get a coarse map from M to R3. Mixing up my notation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But for this 2D thing, it's still some like local object in 2D, right? Just based on this picture you had of the after the nerve map, right? Like, there is this 2D thing.
So actually, I don't think there's a course map from X to a three-dimensional space. I'm fairly certain that's true. You have to subdivide it somehow.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Sorry, maybe just to follow up on this point, but your 2D simplicial complex there. So you started from a code which has, and then it's mapped to a manifold. But is there any sense in which the good quantum code can be defined on this 2D simplicial complex?
Yeah, so that's what I think is that, good quantum codes are defined from combinatorial objects, which are two-dimensional, mm-hmm. roughly. If it's Pantaleev-Kalachev, it's like a twisted product of things. Mm-hmm. Like where there's a base space and a fiber in both of these one-dimensional, and there's some twist. That's like a two-dimensional combinatorial object. Mm-hmm. But the code is not the chain complex you get from the simplices of these two.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. It's additional things. Or if it's like the two-sided Cayley complex, you do have a literal two-dimensional structure. Mm-hmm. It's like a Cayley graph with squares, but then you also impose like extra checks at each vertex, mm-hmm. which are way more complicated than the actual boundary maps. Right. It's like a Tanner code. So this extra Tanner code structure, you don't see it in the I'm not sure how to make this precise, but I think X is related to whatever thing you get the code from, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's like a homological code from it.
Okay, thanks.
Can I ask a very naive question? So what do you mean by subdivide?
That's a good question, because I should have pointed that out. So if you have a simplex like this, mm-hmm. my computer is a little slow. Here's what it means to subdivide it. You pick a vertex on each simplex, each one-dimensional and two-dimensional subsimplex of it like this, and then you put edges like this.
Oh, I see. Okay, thanks.
And you do the same if it's three-dimensional, though it doesn't matter, I guess, because we're only dividing two-dimensional simplicity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good, yeah.
But maybe you have to do, I think this procedure is fine. It's called barycentric subdivision. I don't think it really matters how you subdivide. I think this works as well. The reason we subdivide, just again, is that we have a simplex that's like this, and it gets mapped into a very big one, into R3. And if we subdivide it into many little simplices, then the image of those little simplices will fall into unit balls in R3 under the image. And that's the property we want of our subdivision. Okay, so now we're trying to, so the subdivision, it affects the systole. Maybe I should the reason is that when you subdivide a high dimensional thing into like S times, the volume goes up by like S to the D. If you subdivide a D dimensional thing S times, the volume goes up like S to the D, roughly. But a K-dimensional systole is something about K-dimensional objects inside this D-dimensional space. And so when you subdivide this, potentially this K-dimensional thing will only go up by S to the K. So it will go up by a factor which is much less than the volume. So we have to understand a little bit how, whether like the increase in the volume tracks well with the increase of the systoles under the subdivision. I don't know if that makes sense. Like, I guess in this picture here, we subdivided the triangle into six pieces, but each edge only got subdivided into two pieces. And so the rough way we understand how this, the right, and the how does the subdivision work on M? It's like, it's roughly a pullback of the subdivision on X. So if Z is gonna be a K cycle representing our K systole in M, it's gonna have volume V, which means that it is composed of roughly V K simplices. And I drew a picture on the left of V. So it's some strange shape inside this manifold, which travels all along the manifold because its size is some small constant times the volume of the manifold. So it somehow takes up a lot of space in the manifold. But when we map it to this two-dimensional thing X, mostly it will be concentrated on the edges because this map squishes a lot of dimensions. So in order to, it will also like take up a lot of space in this two-dimensional thing. It has to travel all around, but so it can't be just a bunch of vertices. It has to be connected, but most likely it won't hit most of the, it won't like be take up space inside the two-dimensional triangles inside it. So when we, when we think about the subdivision of M as the pullback of the subdivision of X, what happens to how much Z grows after the subdivision? So each triangle in X gets subdivided into V squared pieces. Each edge of X gets subdivided into V pieces. So as a result, the volume of M tilde is V cubed because we had V simplices and we roughly subdivided each one into V squared. So P times V squared is V cubed. But the K systole, it's kind of like the number of edges in X tilde, which is roughly V times V. So then after we turn M tilde into the code, the size is like V cubed, but the distance is like V squared. That's roughly where those come from. I guess there's a few open questions after all of this. I think the main one is it would be interesting to find a non-probabilistic procedure of this, and maybe one that doesn't involve manifolds. It seems a little auxiliary, and maybe to get rid of this polylog factor. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for a very nice talk. Any questions?
Can I ask?
Yes, please.
I have actually two questions. So one is like, in the past, I was studying this code with the fractal structure. It's like a generalization of the cubic code, and I constructed a family of such codes. It's an explicit construction, but it's based on qubits, not the qubits. Then I wasn't able to prove any lower bound on the call distance, but I know what logical operators look like for some of them. Then I kind of made a conjecture, say like maybe by taking the limit of a local qubit dimension going to infinity, maybe such a code might be saturating the bound, because there is a classical version of the same problem. Like you want to define a local classical code in these spatial dimensions. And then for that, this fractal type construction asymptotically saturate the bound in these spatial dimension. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. And actually that might be I still don't know how to roll around code distance of such code. So yeah, maybe it might work or it might not work, but I have no idea. So second question is very, very naive one. Maybe it's very embarrassingly naive one, but I want to understand your procedure with more concrete example. So if I prepare, like, let's say 3D toric code, then yeah. I can write down C0, C1, C2, right? Then I can represent this 3D toric code in this 2D manifold, but that one is not really local in 2D space. Then does it mean like I can subdivide this manifold and then convert it into 2D code? Is it my
understanding? Yeah, it's a good question. If you take a I think it's called like a 2-1 toric code. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
Okay. So that kind of looks like the two cells inside of a three-dimensional torus. And you take a homological code on those.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you can just you can forget about like all of this M and just let that two skeleton, like the two complex, be X. And then I think it works the same way. Yeah.
I see. Yeah, thanks. Anyway, it's a great work.
Maybe you have to be a little bit careful about making sure like the systoles and the co-systoles of that two-dimensional thing change as you like. But I think I've not checked this, but I think this should be right. And I think actually this is where so this conjecture that's just like applying this procedure to a like a DD toric code.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Because we know about the energy barrier of
I see.
Toric code. So yeah. So I think that's okay. Thanks.
Hi, Duran. You have questions?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Thanks for very amazing talk and work. And can you explain a bit more about the energy? So the codes you are constructing, can you say a bit more about how did you get the energy barrier for them? And this, I'm also confused, this conjecture about energy barrier here, is it for just the code you just described, or is it, I'm just confused, because this dimension is not above by dimension on the previous page you had dimension C's
V3 right power. Right,
but that's a different code presumably.
Yes.
I was wondering, sorry, what is the energy barrier for those ones which have dimension V3 power 1/3?
I don't know.
And the way you're defining barrier is that to go from, let's say, one logical state to another intermediate, whatever maximum energy takes to kind of.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So in manifold, that would be like you have a bunch of, you have like a path of K chains.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at all the paths from zero to some K cycle. That's not a boundary, and you look at how big the boundary of those K chains has to be at some point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that's roughly what I understood is the energy barrier.
So that's not known here somehow so far in this case.
Yeah, and my suspicion is like it's not very good. Like the reason, so in Tor code, there's a reason that the energy barrier is big. It's because, a representative of a K-systol and a torus also looks like a torus. It's kind of very wide. Mm-hmm. It's hard to cut it up. And it's hard to cut it with a small cut, roughly. But in the codes I described, the K-systols, they kind of look like they're near one-dimensional things, roughly. Mm-hmm. So if those one-dimensional things look like expander graphs, then maybe something like that is true. But I'm not sure if that, mm-hmm. that's the case. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So based on that, I guess your guess would be these codes probably don't have any properties like, for example, NLTS or
actually maybe. Now that I think about what I said, maybe they should be. Maybe there is some hope because the one complex of X should kind of look like an expander graph. So maybe, yeah.
Uh-huh. I see.
It's a good question. I don't know.
and so far, I guess you don't have like explicit Hamiltonian, just to make sure, like in three dimensions, you can't write down a Hamiltonian which one can just solve and obtain its various properties, or is it just a matter of working it out, or is it just what is the suppose?
I think this is why Matt like asked me several times about how to do this without manifolds. But yeah, I think it's probably hard. It's probably very tricky too.
I see.
If you have to.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Maybe that's also a better question. Mm-hmm. Not about mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I had a couple of questions, but I don't want to take up all the time. I would rather maybe wait till the end. Everyone else has asked questions, so I can.
So I have very related questions, so maybe just quick questions. So for your energy barrier, 1 over 2 minus 1 over d. For d equals to 4, it's just v to the 1 over 4, right?
Yes.
So that is essentially the energy barrier that's same as the 4D toric code.
Right.
So in that sense, it looks like in terms of energy barrier, you don't have any much like advantage in this method. In 3D, it looks like it's L to the V to the 1 over 6. So what is it? L to the 1 over 2. Yeah.
So it's a little bit different than just the toric code. What it is you start with a toric code and you look at this DD toric code and you look at its like roughly d-dimensional complex, like the middle dimensional complex. Mm-hmm. That's very high dimensional. Yeah. And what you can do is subdivide it, so then you can find a coarse map from that high dimensional thing. Mm-hmm. Sorry, there's another step, which is that you can turn that high dimensional thing into a two-dimensional thing, which is very complicated locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see.
And that's...
Is there any non-rigorous bound for the energy barrier in the generic local code in this partial dimension? In a sense, like the one you conjectured might be saturating, or it could be the best, or maybe not, or any?
I'm not sure I know enough about about the literature to say that.
Okay. Anyway, thanks.
But, right. So it's not, this conjecture is not too interesting. It's like you, it's just you take a toric code and you do something very simple to it compared to Matt Hastings to get a two manifold, and then you subdivide it, and then that subdivided thing is local. That's it. Does anybody know about if there's energy barrier?
Just to clarify, I think, well, the conjecture is certainly interesting because for 3D, I think, as far as I understand, I think the best known energy barriers are logarithmic with L, right? These are like the qubit codes that Benny mentioned, I think.
I think there is a slightly better one. I think maybe Michniki has a paper
about it. Oh, okay. But I thought those have like some important order of limits you have to consider. Or is this actually, like the welded code or something?
Yes, yeah. So maybe that's not like a standard code. I didn't understand it too well, but so it's...
Yeah. But I mean, maybe that doesn't correct me, but I thought that this power law scaling with L in 3D is pretty new. I mean, I don't know.
Well, maybe, yes. I still haven't written out the details, so I shouldn't write it as a theorem yet.
Sorry to clarify, what's the scaling for just the 3D toric code for energy barrier?
So that would be 1/2 minus 1/3. Yeah. Or sorry, that would be, it should be zero, right?
Okay.
It should be constant because you have spring operators.
Right. That's a constant. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is for a DD toric code subdivided.
So we don't know, so far we don't know any code which has even log V or
the qubit code with fractal operators, it does scale with L, right? Like weakly with like log L, right?
Okay. I think.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I see.
There is a lower bound that like if you don't have string operator in 3D, then it's at least log L.
Yeah, sure.
But to get a finite temperature phase transition, is it true that you would need V to the power 1/3 at least? Or V to the power 1/6 is enough to get a transition? Maybe this is, we should not discuss this. Maybe I don't want to pick up time on guessing things, but. Can I ask a couple more questions or I don't know if other people have questions, I can wait.
I think we're just limited by his iPad battery life at this point.
Maybe then I should ask.
Maybe I have a small technical question. So you start to build the manifold M by a good LTPC. So why do you need it to be sparse?
You don't, I think. You can start with a code that's not sparse. And
so as long as it has linear distance and linear dimension, it should be fine.
No, I think that might be less clear to me. I guess I meant that you can build a manifold from a code that isn't sparse, but the manifold has some really complicated local geometry. And I'm not sure, maybe not. It still preserves all the bounds.
So in this, so in your work, you need the LDP code to be sparse to like control your structure of the manifold. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I see. Okay, thanks.
I guess it's important that this was LDP sealed.
Hey, Toron, you want to be quick because.
Sorry, should I ask the question or?
Yeah. You have 45% of battery.
no worries. So I think this is a very naive question. There's no way to go from stabilizer Hamiltonians in general to manifold? Is there, or it's restricted to the CSS codes? Like if you want more general, like a commuting projector Hamiltonian, which doesn't necessarily CSS.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think manifolds are nice for making homological codes. And I'm not so sure what else you would do with a manifold other than take its chain complex to get a code.
Well, I think there is a way to turn like non-CSS into CSS codes by some thing.
I see. By having a high dimensional
I don't think I ever looked at the details, but there is some way.
Maybe by adding a bit of ancillas.
Yeah, I remember there is overhead of ancillas.
Yeah,
right. Constant types of ancillas or something.
I see. I didn't know that. Interesting. So another related question. If I take a hypergraph product code, and repeat your procedure, what do you get in three dimensions in R3? What kind of code do you get?
That's a good question. Matt asked me that.
Whether it's properties, distance, dimension, barrier, and so on.
Well, you can compute that explicitly. There is a formula for what the distance and dimension is of the subdivided code given an input code. It's like you multiply the size by v squared, the distance by v, and then the dimension stays the same.
And the energy barrier?
I don't know.
I see.
Yeah. It's also interesting. I guess it might be interesting to formulate that also, like, more, you might want to know more about this code that you get other than its distance and dimension. Like, what does it actually look like in this, in our time?
Right.
And I'm curious. I don't know.
I just had a naive guess about the code below, just the conjecture one. I don't know, this is going to be a very, very random guess. If I look at free energy as energy minus temperatures time entropy, at least my naive guess would be that the entropy, maybe the right way to think about entropy is maybe the distance, and energy is like energy. So then at least the naive guess would be that the entropy dominates over energy because of this minus one over d factor in the So then maybe there's no phase transition because of that. But this is just a guess. It'll be, of course,
What does it mean to have a phase transition?
It's related to the finite temperature quantum memory, for example. Can there be a stable quantum memory at non-zero temperature or something like that? Yeah, so that you can have qubits which are not susceptible to decoherence. For example, 4D Tori code has that, but 3D, we don't have any simple examples.
What about a 40 Torah code makes it have that? Is it the fact that the energy barrier?
Yeah, energy barrier is like L, I think, and the entropy of the strings is also like L, because the excitations are like string operators. So then energy scales as L of excitation, and entropy also scales with L. So then E minus TS, the free energy, there's a finite temperature TC where you can have below TC, you have well-defined quantum coherence in some sense. So, but it'll be very interesting if this code has that, that'll be obviously pretty amazing. I think I don't have any other question. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, any other final questions?
I have a question, actually.
No.
if you guys are okay with that. I don't have many opportunities to talk to people who understand the physics of quantum codes. So I guess I've recently been asked about implementing logical gates. And I think I have a rough picture of what they are on qubits as like elements in C2 or something like that. But I'm wondering if you guys know if there's like a simple way to, if there is a way to express logical gate in a CSS framework. So far I feel like there hasn't been one that's popped up when I think about it.
By gate, you mean what kind of gate? Like Pauli X, Pauli Y, Pauli Z, these are obvious, right? But like C-node, Clifford gate, or even like
any, I guess gate? It's probably CX and CZ. I think maybe those make sense, but anything more
complicated. I don't know. So I think there are two types of questions. First is more easier one is like we want to understand what kind of Clifford gate, how to implement and so on. And we usually want to have quantum gate which acts transversally, in a sense that the gate should it's like a tensor product form. Then for that, it's just by applying local Clifford gate, stabilizers get changed. So we just need to keep track, like if the stabilizer group itself remains unchanged under such thing. But if we want to study non-Clifford gate, then things becomes more and more complicated. But then I think not so many things are known in general in this kind of a LDPG mm-hmm. code situations. Yeah, and the reason is like we want to have a code with T gate, like non-Clifford gate being transversal, and constructing such a thing is usually very difficult. And there are some rigorous upper bound you can derive if a code has non-Clifford transversal gate. On distance and so on. These are results I and Fernan Pastavsky proved a long time ago by using nice result by Bravi and Koenig. And then, so a code with non-transversal gate, we can have some rigorous bound on the code distance, depending on the spatial dimensions and so on. But mm-hmm. I guess not so much explicit constructions are known, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is helpful to answer your question.
I guess I'm interested like in the bridge between geometry and quantum codes. So my feeling is that quantum gates are kind of like actions on manifolds. Mm-hmm. Manifold to itself that does something on homology. but but I think as a first step, it would be, I would like to understand what a quantum gate is a little bit better, and if it makes sense to define it on a CSS code, or if that's not really the right framework for it.
Maybe one thing to add on this question of gates is, so the picture you drew earlier of the 2D simplicial complex reminded me a lot of this family of codes called color codes. And there you do have this like connection between the properties of this special kind of simplicial complex in D dimensions and the kind of gates you can do. So there's like these saturate the kind of bounds that Benny was talking about. And there does seem to be, you have to have these manifolds kind of with these simplicial complexes, with special properties. And then if you get them, you can show that they will have like interesting gates, including kind of non-Clifford gates.
Is there a reference I can
look at? Oh yeah, I think Hector Bombin has a paper where he tries to explain color code by using this complex, right? I think. And then in my understanding, he is actually the first one to started using that, I think, in the context of stabilizer code. I think was CSS. Yeah. When was it? I think 2010 or even before. I have no idea. It was one of the chapter in the lecture note or some book or something. I think it should be available on archive.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. But the color codes are not, I mean, they're defined as stabilizer codes, I'm guessing, or there's something.
Yeah, it's like stabilizer code, but it's slightly different from that. Toric code, and toric code, you can't do much. Like all you can do is power X, power Y, power Z, but for color code, you can do more than, like full Clifford operations are doable. Mm-hmm. For that, it's very nice.
Okay, thanks for the very nice talk, and I really enjoyed the discussion. Okay, yeah, great. Thank you so much.